Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As more than 44% of the U.S. population has been fully vaccinated for COVID-19, the vaccination rate for preventable diseases in children has gone down during the pandemic. An infectious disease physician explains why even the slightest decline is a concern. Plus, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported the inflation rate is at 5%. We'll talk about how the pandemic factored into all of this and if it's fair to compare this inflation rate to 2008 when we were in the Great Recession. Later in the hour, the Sacramento French Film Festival joins us about the return to in-person screenings with a hybrid event celebrating its 20th anniversary. But first, California's legislature passed the state budget just in time to meet the state's June 15th deadline. While the two legislative houses did agree on the main budget, negotiations with the governor will still take place before it can be fully approved by the deadline at the end of the month. This year's budget has been called historic because it is the highest budget in California state history, despite or partly due to the pandemic, given trillions in federal coronavirus relief. Joining us now to give us some more details about what's included in the budget is California State Assembly member Phil Ting. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first things first, I think it's important to just point out if state lawmakers fail to pass a budget by June 15th, they don't get paid. And this is the second year in a row the state legislature has reached a budget without an agreement with the governor. Republican State Senator Jim Nielsen, he criticized this move. He called it, quote, a fake budget, a let us get paid budget. What is your response to the criticism that this lets lawmakers get paid while continuing to negotiate with the governor?
We're doing our job. We've passed an on-time budget ever since we went to a majority vote budget, and we're proud to continue that trend.
What negotiations still need to occur between the legislature and the governor?
Well, the governor proposed a May revise. We have passed a budget, sent it down to his office, and you could go through the differences between those two documents.
What is allocated in the budget in terms of child care and early childhood education?
Well, it's such an exciting budget for education. As you know, education is about half of our general fund. The general fund this year is going to be $195 billion in terms of our budget. We are setting a record spending for $21,000 per pupil. That's a huge jump from just a few years ago where it was about $15,000 per pupil. And what that really translates to is smaller class sizes, more paraprofessionals, better counselors, more nurses. It's going to be just a boon for K-12 education across the board. It's also a record for early childhood education. We are now moving towards universal transitional kindergarten. Right now, only 25% of children in this state can attend transitional kindergarten, those born between September and December. Now we are phasing in so that every four-year-old is going to get transitional kindergarten, so one extra year of education. In addition, we're asking for higher childcare rates. People can't go back to work if they don't have childcare. That's just a fact. We want more slots for childcare. And that's really what's part of this budget, really central to this. It's a very much family-oriented budget.
I mean, going back to what still needs to be negotiated, what are the main highlights that need to be negotiated to get this budget passed and signed by the governor at the end of the month?
It's a great question. We have a Democratic governor. We have a supermajority of Democrats in the legislature. We agree on everything. It's just a couple fine points in large different parts of the budget. So I imagine that we're going to be getting together over the next couple of days and being able to reach agreement very soon.
When reading the Associated Press wire that came down on Monday, so the Democratic-led state law legislature, the budget estimates $20 billion more than the governor's. Is that true? And can you help people understand that discrepancy?
Yes. So the Department of Finance comes up with their own revenue projections, and we have our own legislative analyst, and they come up with their revenue projections. And like everybody, when you put different economists in the room, you get a multitude of opinions. And so if we could all predict the future, we really wouldn't be here. We'd be doing something else. But I would just suffice it to say that the legislative analyst has been much more able to more accurately predict where we are revenue-wise the last number of years.
And I think it's also just important to remind people that, you know, initially, you know, the state thought that they were going to have a more than $50 billion deficit. And now, you know, combined with federal coronavirus aid, the state has more than $100 billion of new money to spend. Can you just remind people how we flipped like that over the past year?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. So 2 years ago, our general fund was about $154 billion going into this last budget. And again, you have to have the context. When we passed the budget in June, we were 3 months into COVID. We had no idea how long we'd have to shut down for, the impact on our economy, who was going to be impacted. We really had no idea. So we passed a very conservative budget. So we went from a general fund of about $154 billion to about $133 billion general fund. So that's a $20 billion drop. Now, this year, we brought in a lot more than $133 billion. And so therefore, seeing that trend, we also feel fairly confident that to predict that we are going to be able to hit our general fund revenues. The legislative analyst is a very conservative organization in terms of their fiscal prudence. They're known, they're a bipartisan organization, so they serve both parties. They don't just serve the majority party in the legislature, and they very much establish their revenues based on very rigorous economic analysis.
Yeah, just going through some of the highlights that stood out. So they're actually will be potentially tax rebates up to more than $1,000 per person for most taxpayers?
Yeah, we are going to do the second round of the Golden State stimulus, and that's going to be $8 billion in tax refunds. We're going to do $1.5 billion additional money to small businesses and nonprofits. So that's on top of the money that we've already done this year. And then $2 billion in small business tax breaks, because we anticipate at some point they're going to have an increase in their unemployment insurance. So we want to get ahead of that, really help mitigate that potential unemployment increase with some tax breaks, especially for our smallest businesses and our mom and pop businesses. The other thing I really wanted to point out is, as you know, the biggest issue before we went into COVID was housing and homelessness. So this is a historic investment in housing and homelessness. You can look around Sacramento to see the devastation there. I'm from San Francisco. It's a real issue all across the state. So it's $8.5 billion over 2 years in new homelessness funding. $1 billion of that is to local governments for flexible funding. So to places like the city of Sacramento, city of San Francisco, up and down the state to our major cities to really implement flexible, innovative solutions to get folks off the street. Also $2 billion for affordable housing. We have a number of projects just waiting to be built. So that's $1.75 billion of that is for projects that are shovel ready, ready to be built, ready to go. We give them funding. And so we expect to have shovels in the ground due to that funding.
That level of investment when it comes to housing and particularly homelessness, has that level been devoted by before or proposed before by the state?
No, it's interesting. I would say, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, the state was really getting out of the housing business. The housing agencies were shrinking. And what we saw is local governments have really not been able to come together to figure out a statewide housing solution. Everybody agrees we need to build more housing. No one agrees that they need to build it or their cities need to be involved in building it. So we saw really a huge need on behalf of the state to be much more aggressive in terms of passing state law. I've been very aggressive about streamlining our ADU processes for really including much more funding for housing. I mean, we have a housing crisis. It's a huge problem. Our economy could come to a halt if we don't build enough housing. We have a generation of people between 20 to 40 who can't afford to purchase a home. And that's really never happened before in our state's history.
Can you talk about the proposal to offer health insurance to older undocumented immigrants?
Yes, that's one of our most exciting proposals. We believe in universal health care. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, we've gotten to about 92-93% insured in California. We want to get to 100% insured. And so by offering Medi-Cal to people who are 50 and older, it's a huge step in that direction. And it, regardless of their documentation, one horrible thing that the Affordable Care Act does is it doesn't apply to people who don't have documents. And so people who are working hard every single day, they are in the fields, they're in our hotels, they're in our variety of industries all over our state working, they don't get the benefits from the federal government for affordable health insurance. So this is one way the state can step in and really close that gap.
And more than $3 billion is going to address the drought, or is proposed to address the drought. We're entering what is projected to be a strong wildfire season. How will that money be broken down to combat, you know, one of the biggest overarching issues that we face as a state?
Yeah, the challenge with such a large budget is many of the details will still need to be worked out, even going into the fall after we've set aside the money. So I imagine $3.7 billion for drought, $3.7 billion for climate change, $1 billion for wildfires. There's $7 billion in here for broadband. Many of those details will still need to be worked out in trailer bill between now and the end of our session, which is in September.
You know, finally, there was some current concern among GOP state senators about just the outlying risk of inflation. I mean, we do have a record surplus, but we also are currently experiencing inflation. What is your response to that in terms of planning financially for the future, for the years and decades to come?
Yeah, the inflation really is under the purview of the Federal Reserve. They're the ones who are really in charge of monetary policy. Something obviously we can look at and be concerned about. What I would say is inflation looks a little bit exacerbated just because during the pandemic, we actually saw prices come down. And so the percentage jump is not based on the baseline from 2019. It's based on a 2020 COVID price decrease. And so it looks like a much bigger jump than I think you would we would normally think. At this point, inflation is incredibly small. For those of us who lived through the 70s, where we had, you know, 15% interest rates and things like that, which is a long item of the past, this is, you know, not very much to be concerned about. Obviously, we have to continue to monitor it, but at this point, it's not a concern.
Finally, what needs to happen between now and the end of the month?
I think we just need to get together with the governor's office and iron out a lot of these details. I think we're very excited about this budget. This budget is very much focused on recovery, helping so many of those families that suffered recover from this pandemic, but then also laying the foundation for the future. We have in this budget also a huge package for higher education to make higher education cheaper and debt-free and also increase access to our UC and CSU system. So it's really ensuring that we set and invest in the human capital for the next 50 years, which is really the strongest source of capital in our entire state.
State Assemblymember Phil Ting, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Vicki. Nice to be here.
Up next, we hear from an infectious disease expert about the drop in routine pediatric immunizations, plus what the 5% inflation rate we just talked about it means for the economy. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're You're listening to Inside here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The world has a long history of vaccines. Since the 18th century, when the first smallpox vaccine was created, scientists have worked to create and improve immunizations in order to help fight off diseases that were once deadly. When the world came to a pause 15 months ago, so did routine healthcare for many, and that includes the health care of children. The CDC released a report last week showing preliminarily that routine vaccinations for children fell at the beginning of the pandemic. And although doses increased last fall, it wasn't enough to close the vaccine gap. Yesterday, we spoke with Dr. Krutika Kupali to get a better understanding of the significance of this drop in routine vaccinations. She's an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Medical University of South Carolina.
Yeah, so early on in the pandemic, particularly here in the United States in the first part of 2020, it looked like that there was a drop in the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines among children. It looked like there's a drop in the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, and also a decline in the HPV vaccine. So those are all concerning. We've also seen on a global scale delays and disruptions to vaccine rollout programs for measles, mumps, and rubella, as well as polio. So those are all very concerning.
What are the overarching concerns that you have as a physician?
Well, obviously, the overarching concern is that we're going to see re-emergence of some of these vaccine-preventable diseases. Things like measles. We've had outbreaks of measles over the past couple of years. And so the concern is that as we start to have people come back together, as we could have outbreaks of measles. We could have outbreaks of pertussis, which people more commonly know as whooping cough. So those are all concerns, I think, as well as things that we may not commonly see as much, right? So people don't commonly think of seeing things like mumps, but we could have that starting to pop up again. And again, like I said, on a global scale, we've seen that. So we've seen cases of polio being reported. We've seen cases of measles being reported. And so those are all extremely concerning. We've also seen cases of diphtheria in places like Nepal, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. So the emergence of these diseases that have been previously under control is very concerning.
The CDC just released recent data, just a few days ago last Friday, and they surveyed between basically March to September of 2020. They found that vaccinations dropped at the beginning of the pandemic. There was a rebound last fall, but it wasn't enough to catch up on pediatric vaccinations. They also were concerned that even a slight temporary decline in these vaccinations is concerning. Can you explain how so?
Exactly. So even a slight decline in these vaccinations is concerning because, again, if you have a decline in immunity, you can have people who get exposed and then they can expose other people. And so if people aren't getting their vaccines on schedule, that puts them at risk for getting infected and then having onward spread of these infections. And so it is really important for people to keep their appointments, to get vaccinated on schedule. And on top of that, if they haven't gotten their vaccines, to make those appointments, to plan ahead and schedule their appointments now, so their children can be protected.
You know, you touched upon measles in the beginning and you know, noticing that there has been a drop in recent years. The recent drop in the last year, it does follow successful decades of reducing vaccine-preventable diseases, you know, due in part to vaccinating children. Are COVID shutdowns only the only culprit? Because, you know, there has been vaccine hesitancy prior to the pandemic, and top of mind is the measles vaccine.
Well, we have had some recent years of very large measles outbreaks, and the United States almost lost its certification of being measles free. And so I think that we need to remember how important it is to make sure everybody's getting vaccinated for measles, mumps, rubella. Measles is highly contagious, and it can cause a lot of serious side effects, and people can die from measles. And so it is really, really important for people to stay on top of these vaccinations. And it's not just because we're socially distancing that we're not seeing these cases. Again, these are diseases that can come back up, and it's really, really important to sustain our herd immunity. So we're not just having young people get infected, but also remember, we have a whole host of immune compromised people that we don't want to get infected as well. And our older population, immune compromised, they can't necessarily get the MMR vaccine because it's a live vaccine. So there's a lot of reasons and a lot of very important things we need to think about when it comes to vaccination.
With that in mind, how does COVID-19 and the risk of that further compound the concerns that you're sharing with us?
Well, I mean, obviously, COVID-19 has been a very scary time for everybody. It's been a life-changing time for everybody. But hopefully, the lessons learned from COVID is really that vaccines are important. Look at how we've been doing here in the United States, because we've been lucky enough to have an aggressive vaccine rollout campaign. We're seeing cases going down, we're seeing hospitalizations going down, and that really is a testament to the vaccine campaign. And I really think people need to understand how important that is, and that relates to other important infectious diseases that we've been lucky enough to develop vaccines for. And we really need to, use our vaccines to try and prevent the onset of other infectious diseases.
If this lag in a catch-up of vaccinations, mostly for children, vaccine-preventable diseases, is it even more concerning given that schools are going to be reopening this coming fall?
Yes, absolutely. Remember, once you get people close together, particularly, in the fall and the winter, we get worried about, increased infections. We also worry about, again, if we drop below that level of herd immunity that we need, then we worry about increased numbers of infections. And also remember, again, as I mentioned earlier, there are certain people who can't get vaccines for whatever reason, right? So people who are immune compromised may not be able to get the MMR vaccine. So we depend on other people to get their vaccines as needed so we can protect other people. So it's important for everybody to, quote unquote, be a good citizen and do their part. We all need to rely on each other. We're all in this together. We all need to protect ourselves and protect the other people in our community.
How can parents get back on track with their children's vaccines? Do they do it all at once? Do they spread it out over the span of a few weeks or months even?
Yeah, that's a really great question. What I would recommend is that they contact their pediatrician and schedule appointments now so they can plan ahead and get their children back on track with their vaccines. I think part of that's going to depend on how far behind their children are and what vaccines they need.
Do you think schools should require kind of current immunization records when classes do reopen come fall, just to ensure that these vaccine preventable diseases that these children are caught up on their vaccinations?
Well, as an infectious disease doctor, I am always in favor of doing everything we can to try and prevent the spread of infectious diseases. So I don't think that's a bad idea to make sure that we have current immunization records for children. I think that's especially with, a lot of places having been remote and virtual for the past year.
What can healthcare providers do to better inform parents about the importance of vaccinations and routine visits?
Well, I think, some of the things that we've been doing just for about the COVID vaccine, right? I think it's important to educate parents and children. You can never start educating people at a young enough age. Explain to them why it's important to get vaccinated. Explain to them how vaccines work. And I think it's important for people to understand that these are, scientifically based and scientifically tested medications. And why they're so good. You know, I think one of the things we talk about a lot in our community is that, you know, maybe part of the reason we see so much vaccine hesitancy now is that people don't remember what it's like to have diseases like polio. They don't remember what it's like to see rampant measles around. They don't remember these things. And so those diseases are horrible diseases. And, you know, we've been lucky that we don't see them in our generation, but I think it's really important to remember how deadly these diseases can be. And so it's very important for us to educate people on the wonderful efficacy of these vaccines and what they can do to not just protect us again, but our loved ones, our friends, our family members.
Finally, given that you are an infectious disease researcher and physician, looking ahead as, you know, California's reopening, the country is reopening, what are you going to be looking at for the remainder of the year? What are your concerns?
Well, I think I have a number of concerns. I think, first of all, I'm definitely concerned about what's going to happen as we reopen more with some of these vaccine-preventable diseases. Are we going to see a reemergence of them because of some of the lower vaccine rates? So I think it is going to be important that we make sure that we get people caught up and make sure that we are doing good educational campaigns to inform people. I think the other thing I'm worried about is what's going to happen with COVID. So we have this new Delta variant that seems to be more transmissible, possibly more virulent. And I am concerned that that's going to become the dominant strain here in the United States. I'm worried about people who have not been vaccinated for COVID. I'm worried about people who may have only gotten one shot of their COVID vaccine. I'm also worried about people who are immune compromised, and we don't know about how well their antibody response has been to the COVID vaccine, and if they are going to be increasingly susceptible to getting COVID. So I think we need to keep an eye on those people as well. And then finally, I'm worried about influenza season. You know, something we haven't talked a lot about, but we were worried about that last year. And, you know, the good news last year is we didn't really see any flu, which was great. But because we didn't see any flu, that's going to be hard to determine what the flu vaccine should look like this year. And as people start coming together this year, the concern is we're going to see flu. And so what that's going to look like on top of all the other things I mentioned. And so it's going to be extremely important for people to get their flu shots, but it's also going to be important for us to see how well the flu shot works against whatever ends up becoming the circulating strain of influenza and what those numbers are going to look like. So I think there are a number of things for us to keep an eye on. And I think, you know, the underlying fundamentals that we've been reinforcing over the past year and a half are going to be important. So, you know, people maintaining good hand hygiene and maintaining social distance and, you know, we know that masks work and preventing infection. So if you're sick, make sure to wear a mask. And I think if you're sick, make sure to stay home. I think those have been some of the important things that we've all learned over the last year and a half, and not forgetting the lessons we've learned from the pandemic.
That was my conversation with Dr. Krutika Kupali. She's an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Medical University of South Carolina. Our conversation was recorded yesterday. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, the U.S. is seeing the highest inflation rate since 2008. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the inflation rate has increased by 5% over the past year. But the White House and Democrats say the rising inflation is temporary and the economy will rebound from the pandemic. While it may be a temporary spike, some experts still believe it may take months before we see if that assumption is true, with price hikes everywhere from the food we eat to new and used cars and clothes. Here to help us understand a little more about what's going on with the economy is finance professor at Sacramento State University, Sanjay Varshney. Welcome back to Insight.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sanjay, just before we start, can you just walk us through what exactly the inflation rate is and why it's so important in this context?
So inflation rate, the easiest way to explain it is if you look at a basket of goods and services that Americans consume, we call it the Consumer Price Index, so the CPI, right? So we are looking at whether or not that the price of that basket of goods and services increases, over periods of time. And when you're talking about the 5% inflation number that just came out recently, which is causing a lot of conversation, I think in general, prices have gone up. So if you look at the price of lumber, you look at the price of copper, you look at the price of cars, like you said, if you look at the prices of homes, obviously we were used to the price of educational tuition, healthcare, costs going up over time. But I think for the longest time, given the last great recession, in general, the United States was struggling to get inflation to come up to at least 2%, which is a sharp contrast to what we have experienced in the past. So if you go back to, let's say, 1980 or earlier than 1980, and I know this is going to be tough for people to relate to because half of the population of the United States was born after 1981. But we used to experience double-digit inflation. So if you go back to, for example, 1979, 1980, we not only had double-digit inflation, as a result, we saw rates in general for borrowing, very high across the board, including, for example, a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage would be close to about 18% compared to the less than 3% that you see right now. So for the longest time, inflation was actually well under 2%. We were struggling to get it up to 2%, which was a healthy number. Now, suddenly, because of COVID and everything else that happened in the last 1 year, that inflation number is inching up. The reason why people are concerned is because high inflation means people have to pay higher prices for the same goods and services, and incomes may not have changed as much to be able to afford those.
I mean, is this 5% in inflation? I mean, is it manageable in the lens or the argument that's being made that it's temporary due to reopening and pent-up spending?
Yes, very much. So I think I have to remind ourselves that, this is not a normal economy. So we should not be looking at a short-term data point and suddenly trying to extrapolate that to mean basically what the economy is going to look like a year from now or 2 years from now. So when we talk about the inflation number being transitory, eventually when the supply shock, clearly we have seen a huge disruption to the supply chain. I think the demand cycle is coming back very aggressively. Just think about the fact that when California reopened yesterday, basically, that's a ticket now for everybody to go out and spend more money on things they were not able to because, not because they couldn't, it's because they were not able to because things were closed. So now the demand side of the cycle is going to shoot up really hard, right? So people are going to go out to restaurants. They're going to go out and basically spend money on other things that they were not able to. The supply side is still very, very iffy because with COVID, remember how we had the toilet paper issue? Where we couldn't find for months, things on the shelves. So we still see disruptions to the supply chain. And as much as I know people like to basically have instant gratification and they would like to see everything become perfect again on the flip of a switch, it's not going to happen because the economy takes time to come back to into balance. So the supply side and the demand side eventually will come into balance is the assumption being made by the Federal Reserve. And that's why they're saying the inflation number is transitory, which means that eventually that 5% number will come back down again, because that has been the trend for the last 10 years. As I said, not just in the United States, but globally, we have struggled to get inflation up to a normal or healthy number because we have an aging population worldwide. The prices have been very competitive. Each time somebody wants to charge more, the Amazons of the world basically make things cheaper, for people. So inflation, we did not really see inflation. In fact, we were talking about deflation for the longest time. But now suddenly we are talking about inflation. And 5% I know sounds scary compared to the 2% or lower number we were used to in the United States. But I have to, again, like I said, remind ourselves, this is not a normal economy. Don't hang your hat on that 5% number too much.
Well, the Federal Reserve is meeting today. What tools does the Federal Reserve have to respond to this if they decide that, you know, that this is egregious inflation?
So, again, patience is the key here. Now, as much as I know people are getting excited about the 5% number, look at the bond market. For the longest time, and in my opinion, having been in the investment industry for over 35 years, I can tell you the bond market is way smarter than everybody else combined at the table. And the bond market has been telling us the 10-year Treasury yield actually went down, which is basically telling us that inflation, as much as we were thinking is going to be out of control, actually is going to come back into sync. So that's a very good sign, that the bond market actually is giving us a very, very healthy sign that inflation might be transitory. Secondly, lumber prices have rolled over. I'm not sure if you've been watching the prices over the last week or two.
Oh, yeah.
But lumber prices are no longer going up. If anything, they're crashing right now. So that's another healthy sign that eventually whatever was going up too much or too rapidly is going to come back down into sync. Finally, if, let's say, we find that there is persistent inflation, which means that in spite of everything else we have at the table, you know, you find that inflation is running away, I think the Federal Reserve has tremendous tools in their toolkit to be able to basically respond to it. The very first being increasing the interest rates across the board. So if you talk about the discount rate, the federal funds rate, those are the tools that typically, you know, the Federal Reserve basically starts with. And right now, keep in mind, you know, for the longest time, we have seen a very low interest rate environment. So for the last 36 years in a row, our interest rates have been much lower compared to where they used to be before that. The Federal Reserve brought down the rates to zero in response to the COVID crisis and promised that they're going to keep the rates at zero maybe till 2022 or 2023. So what we have to watch today is the tone the Federal Reserve is going to use today in the meeting to indicate whether or not they believe that they may have to react sooner than later and increase those rates. Instead of waiting till 2023, they might be forced to raise those rates in 2022. And I think by now, monetary policy, as much as has been a trial and error in the past, I think the Federal Reserve is able to do a better job today using those rates to basically control inflation. So that's the first tool. Like I said, there are many other tools I can talk about. But I think, like I said, the one fear that people are still, you know, putting on the table as a reason for high anxiety for inflation is that for the first time ever in our history, in our lives, we have seen Congress and the Federal Reserve put more than $13, $14 trillion on the table as a response to the COVID crisis. We have never seen so much free money put on the table. And so obviously it's anybody's common sense that basically will allow them to believe that, you know, with so much free money on the table, how can you not have inflation? How can you not have inflation issues going forward? And so those are reasonable fears. But like I said, there's plenty of tools in the toolkit.
Well, with that in mind, I mean, is this inflation, I mean, is it even really comparable to other periods of economic hardship? Because, you know, the Great Recession is kind of brought up in tandem with this current inflation.
It is not. So that's why, you know, we're trying to make too much, we are trying to read too much into one data point that just came out for May. And I think we have to be patient and we have to basically, at least allow the economy to come back into sync. The demand and supply forces are still at play. The country has not reopened fully yet. Once the reopening is done, we have to wait for several weeks past that reopening. And then I think at that point in time, we'll have a trend. We'll probably see exactly what that trend looks like. And then I think we can take that trend and basically take it home and react to it.
Sanjay Varshney is a finance professor at Sacramento State University. Always a pleasure, Sanjay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still ahead, the Sacramento French Film Festival celebrates its 20-year anniversary and is returning with a hybrid event this year. We'll have the details. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California is officially opened back up. Now, with this comes the return of arts and culture events to allow for many people to enjoy all those concerts, plays, and movies that we have been without for more than a year. In Sacramento, the French Film Festival has officially been around for 20 years. And after a virtual festival last year, organizers are ready to bring back some of the in-person or in-theater aspects for this hybrid event. Joining us now to tell us more about what films will be featured this year is French Film Festival Executive and Artistic Director Cécile Downs. Welcome to Insight.
Hi. Well, thank you for having me. Sorry, I thought you were going to unmute me.
That is perfect.
I'm all new to this Zoom interview.
Exactly. That is perfectly fine. I think that is actually the best segue to my question. You know, after being virtual last year, how are you feeling putting together a hybrid festival and actually welcoming people in person for your 20th anniversary?
Well, we're very excited, but we're also very careful. We want to make sure because, you know, we're just happening when just a few days after California is reopening entirely. So we just want to be careful, and we want to reassure people that we'll still, as much as we can, you know, have we'll encourage people to still wear masks, and we usually do not sell reserved seating, but that's what we're doing, so people can choose their seat, and so it should be a good experience, and we have wonderful films, and so we're very excited to actually welcoming people back in theater, and we're also very excited to give also the opportunity for people who do not who are not ready, or for people who live too far away, to still see our films online, because it worked very well last year.
You know, given the uncertainty of the past year and as things were developing when it came to restrictions and what was allowed, I mean, what went into preparing for what is now at least a hybrid festival? Because I would imagine a couple months ago, you didn't even know if that was going to be possible.
Exactly. That's, I mean, it was the same thing last year, actually. We had to switch to virtual very quickly. And then this year, it's the difference. We were preparing for a virtual event. And then, you know, we were listening to Governor Newsom's press conference and saying, oh, it's coming. And, oh, we're opening in June, and Sacramento and California's reopening we're opening on the 18th, Sacramento's reopening on the 15th. And so, you know, we had to just go for it. And there was no way. We're very happy to also support the theaters where we usually have our events. And they also have been extremely supportive with us. We're just really working in partnership with them to make everything work the way it should.
Well, so you are going to have some feature films that are going to be presented virtually this year. But as you mentioned, you know, the rest are also going to be shown at the Esquire IMAX Theater, the Crest Theater. So talk to us about what films will be shown in person at these theaters.
So we are very excited about our in-theater program, actually. So at the Esquire IMAX on this Sunday, we will present the two films that won major awards at the French Academy Awards, and that's including the Best Animated Feature. It's called Josette, and it's an adult film. It's a film about a war prisoner right before World War I, when Spanish refugees came to France and were put in camps by the French government. So it's a really beautiful film, and we'll actually have the screenwriter on a Zoom discussion the following Friday. Is in France, and then we are showing at 5 p.m. Bye Bye Morons, which is the film that won most of the awards at the César this year. I think it won 7, and it included the best film and the best director. And it's from one of our favorite film directors. It's a comedy, it's an adventure. His films are always very hard to describe because they're just totally unique. And so it's beautiful. We're very happy to show the film.
Well, I think on that note, we actually have a clip of Bye Bye Moron. So let's share that with listeners and we'll unpack it a little bit afterward.
Il n'existe aucune trace de votre accouchement. Puis retrouver un enfant abandonné sous X depuis 30 ans, c'est très difficile.
À ce point?
Oui, ça c'est normal. Hein. Donner ses données, reprendre ses volets.
Je m'excuse, mais je trouve ça trop injuste.
Quoi, on peut rien faire alors?
Ça peut prendre du temps.
Mais c'est-à-dire, j'ai un souci de santé.
Si vous êtes pressé, on s'en sort plus.
Excusez ma grossièreté. Adieu les cons.
You know, what I love about that is even though, you know, we're radio and we can't see what's going on and there is a lot going on, you can actually hear you can actually hear that there's a lot going on here. Can you just explain
yes.
what the trailer was about and kind of give us a sense of what the movie is about?
So the movie is about a woman who found out that she has a terminal illness, and she absolutely wants to find the son that she had to abandon when she was a teenager. And so she goes to the social services trying to find that, and there she meets a man, Albert Dupontel, who's having a burnout and he wants to kill himself, but, you know, it doesn't go as planned, and I don't want to say more. It's just like going and I'm going and going. The characters are amazing. The acting is fantastic. I mean, if people look at the trailer, there's just like things going on all the time, just like you said.
Yeah, there's a lot of commotion just auditorially too. I also want to play one more. And if you can translate.
Sorry,
after...
I just also wanted to say all the films have subtitles because we're showing listening to the clips in French, but you know, you do not need to speak French, obviously. And we're also going to have another screening at the Crest, and that would be Saturday, the following Saturday on the 26th. And we're showing a classic film, and we'll have a guest in person at the theater, so that we're very excited. And we're hoping to also be able to offer a glass of champagne. We're working on that, so it would really be going back to theater with the festive atmosphere that we usually provide.
Yeah, and that would be, it's so fitting given not only last year, but the fact that this is the 20th anniversary. I think
exactly.
A glass of
it
bubbly
was very
is
sad
deserved.
For us to think we would not be in theater at all for the 20th year. So it's good that we are.
Well, I wanted to play another clip. This is an animated film that's suitable for children that can be watched online. And it's called The Bear's Famous Invasion. And as you mentioned, there are subtitles. But if you can translate a little bit afterward, I just want to give listeners a feel of how it sounds.
De la nature, il y a des instincts que nous ne devons pas perdre.
Ouais, mais l'eau est quand même un peu fraîche. Là.
Je suis un animal. Hein?
C'est ça. Envoyez.
J'ai conquis la Sicile pour te retrouver. Et regarde-toi, tu voudrais être un homme. Tu n'es même pas un ours.
All right, I feel the drama with that one. And it is an animated film for all families, which is great. Can you tell us about it?
It's based on a famous Italian children's story. And it's about how the bears who have no food and whose... also the son of the king's bear has been abducted by human, and so they decide to go into the human world to try to find food and the son. And there's a lot of adventures. There's some war, and then there's peace between the bear and the man, and then peace doesn't stay long. So it's like it's full of adventure, but it's really. It's got a little, you know, Lion King feel in a way at the beginning, but the second part is very different. The animation is beautiful, and of course, not all kids can read subtitles, so it has to be kids who can read. But I think that the animation is so beautiful that even a younger kids could appreciate, and you don't always need the words to understand with an animated film.
Well, I'm so excited for you this weekend. The Sacramento French Film Festival kicks off this weekend, and we are joined by executive and artistic director Cecile Downs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicky.
Well, that's Insight for today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director, Mark Jones, and our engineer is Stephen Starbuck. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.